We're turning now in the Sermon on the Mount to Matthew chapter 5 and verse 21. Matthew 5, and we begin our reading at verse 21. You have heard that it was said to people long ago, "Do not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment. Again, anyone who says to his brother, 'Raca,' is answerable to the Sanhedrin. But anyone who says, 'You fool,' will be in danger of the fire of hell. Therefore, if you are offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First go and be reconciled to your brother, then come and offer your gift. Settle matters quickly with your adversary who is taking you to court. Do it while you are still with him on the way. He may hand you over to the judge. The judge may hand you over to the officer. You may be thrown into prison. I tell you the truth, you will not get out until you have paid the last penny." May the Lord bless the reading and hearing of his word. Now, throughout the rest of this chapter, Jesus will deal with six examples of true Christianity. And here is a formula that you can watch for. First, he reminds them of what they have heard. Jesus will use words to this effect: "You have heard it said by them of long ago." But remember, what has happened in the intervening years after the law was given is that the Pharisees had discovered some loopholes. They found some ways in order to keep their rules but get around these commandments. And so what happens is that Jesus asserts his authority by closing the loophole and by affirming God's original intent. And Jesus uses this formula: "You have heard it said by them of old, but I say unto you." Now, that's very radical. Because in the Jewish culture, whenever the rabbis or the authorities, the spiritual leaders, when they were asked any question, they never cited their own authority, but they would always refer to precedent that had been set. Rabbi so-and-so says this, Rabbi so-and-so says that. But Jesus does not cite another rabbi. Jesus says, "I'm telling you, this is what God meant when he gave us the law." And so here we're dealing with the sixth commandment. The sixth commandment is that we should not murder. Now, many of you may feel that I can put this on fast forward, that none of us here are guilty of that, and so this is something that really does not pertain to us. But lest you think that we can skip over this section, Jesus goes to the heart of the matter and he deals with anger. You see, if we resolve anger, we will never be guilty of murder. But unresolved anger leaves us vulnerable to things we may not think are possible. Now, it's unrealistic to think that Christians would never disagree. Many of Paul's letters are written to churches who are in conflict with each other. Holy living does not produce a marriage with no misunderstandings, a church with no difference of opinion, or a person who never is upset. I read to you at the outset of our service this morning from Ephesians 4:26, "Be angry, and yet do not sin." All anger is not sinful, but it can quickly lead to sin if it's not resolved. Therefore, Jesus is telling us here that conflict has to be resolved quickly. And he warns us that unresolved anger can quickly get out of control. Let's notice this in four steps. He tells us in verse 22 about someone who is angry with his brother. And he's telling us here that it needs to be resolved quickly. Notice that the earliest manuscripts do not contain this exception, that who do not be angry without a cause. You see, both sides of any dispute will always have a cause or a reason or an excuse for their anger. But regardless of whatever the cause is, regardless of whatever he said or what she did, it still has to be addressed. Now, Jesus uses a word in verse 22 for anger that describes a brooding, simmering anger that is nurtured and fed and not allowed to die. Some people blow up. Other people clam up. It's the second kind that's the worst. Some people get it off their chest and it's over with. Some people hold it within and it just seethes and boils. And that's why Paul told us, don't let the sun go down while you're still angry. Because in doing so, you're giving the devil a foothold. In verse 25, Jesus says, settle matters quickly with your adversary. But the subject that we're looking at here does not settle matters quickly. He is furious and he nurses that anger. And notice what happens when this anger is allowed to go unchecked. The second level is that unresolved anger leads to contempt. No longer do we see that other person as a brother. No longer do we call him brother. But here, Jesus warns that we're not to call our brother Raca. Now, you may breathe a sigh of relief and say, you know, honestly, Pastor, I've said a lot of bad words, but I've never said that one. Well, that misses the whole point. It is brought over into our Bible untranslated. But it is a term of contempt. It is a term of insult. And so let me close the loophole again. It actually would be translated to call someone a fool or call someone empty-headed. You said, but I didn't call him Raca. I called him a blockhead. Well, it's the same difference. We're not dealing with the actual words. We're dealing with the attitudes. You know, when my girls were growing up, I always called them some kind of a nickname, usually knucklehead or something like that. But they knew that I was never serious about that, and I would have been very distraught if I thought that they had any doubt as to whether I love them or not. What Jesus is saying here is that we are all created in the image of God. We all have intrinsic worth, and the worth of a human being is not based on race or economics or social or educational classifications. We cannot allow ourselves to view someone else as worthless, even though we may strongly disagree with them. And the fact is, we may be diametrically opposed to everything they stand for. Let me just say, as we come down to the final weeks of another political campaign, we as Christians have to avoid sweeping generalizations. We cannot simply dismiss a candidate with whom we disagree and say that they are empty-headed or lack intelligence. We must debate ideas and agendas. We cannot resort to just dismissing someone by calling them some kind of a label. I'm also concerned in school that sometimes children treat each other with contempt and call each other ugly names. We're aware that bullying is now something that's on our radar. I think it's always been there, but now we're more tuned into it. And children who are insecure about their identity may accept a label that is thrown at them and conclude that they are worthless. What Jesus is saying here is that no one is worthless. That's our Christian worldview. We may disagree with everything they stand for, but we must show respect to the person. And to be angry at a person and never resolve that can lead to contempt. Now notice the third step. Contempt can lead to hatred. First I'm angry with you, then I have contempt for you. Now I call you a fool. Now the difference is Raca, it stands for any term that would express contempt for a man's head. You may say he's empty-headed, he's stupid, he's foolish. But fool, now it goes a step beyond that. It refers to his character. Here, this word fool could be translated as scoundrel. And we're not simply saying you're dumb. We also say you're wicked. You see, that's even a step worse. I cannot help but remember when I was growing up, I used to play with two boys, and the two brothers would get into it, and the younger one would invariably call his older brother a fool. Well, I think it's the only verse the boy knew in the Bible, but his older brother would quote this verse back to him and say, anybody who calls someone else a fool is in danger of hellfire. And so we had some pretty serious theological discussions there for just a moment. I always felt like that was a little bit over the top. Again, it's not that I can call you 50 other bad words so long as I avoid calling you a fool. No, it's the attitude, it's the belief that you're a scoundrel, that you're worthless. You know, just to make my point, in Matthew 23, verse 17, Jesus refers to the Pharisees as blind fools. It's the very same word. And so Jesus is not contradicting his own teaching because he is not speaking to them out of hatred or out of anger. He is simply rebuking them or confronting them. And he is warning them that they in fact will go to hell. And all of their man-made rules are taking other people to hell along with them. And so realize that it is not the word that is prohibited so much as the attitude. You can't get by calling somebody a moron instead of a fool. You know, the actual Greek word here, if I were to pronounce it, is the word moron. That's an interesting thing. But it's not the word. It's what the word implies. In the Bible, a fool is not simply someone who is stupid. In the Bible, in the wisdom literature, a fool is someone who is in rebellion against God. And so this is a matter not simply of intelligence. We're not simply saying he's empty-headed, but we're saying this, his heart is empty, or his heart's full of sin. In the Bible, a fool is someone who has rejected God and is headed for hell. And so what Jesus is really warning us about is that I can get so angry at someone that I consign them to hell. Sometimes people are so angry they tell their opponent to go to hell. You see, he's not a fool, he's our brother. And Jesus warns that if we are consigning everyone else to hell, that we may be more in danger of going there ourselves. You see how this escalates. I allow anger to seethe to the point that it can't be resolved without going to court. Someone else has to step in and arbitrate. I've lost my head. Then I develop such a contempt, it goes to the highest court, to the Sanhedrin. Finally, I'm consumed with such hatred and rage that only God can step in. And the final step is that hatred can lead to murder. You say, well, it would never happen in my case. And that's, I'm sure, what many people feel who have committed murder. Therefore, Jesus tells us to settle matters before they get out of hand. You know, we don't have to turn many pages in the Bible till we find in the first family, in the newly created world that God had made, that Cain is so angry, and he allows that angry to seethe on the back burner until it overtakes him and he kills his brother Abel. Today, there's a whole generation of Palestinians that are being raised to hate the Jew who has displaced them from their land. The Jew is raised in fear of the Arab, and there's hatred on both sides. And yet, the irony is both claim Abraham as their father. Isn't that the irony of it all? That they have allowed this hatred to actually cause them not to think clearly. But we don't have to go to the Mideast to see this kind of a blind hatred. A disgruntled employee will bring a gun to work and go on rampage. And invariably, I can predict what the news reporters will report. They'll say he was such a nice, quiet man. Nobody ever suspect. Isn't that what they all say? He was such a nice, quiet, but you see, the problem is we didn't know what was boiling on the back burner. He did not resolve it. And an angry student will bring a gun to school and force a lockdown. You know, many times terrorists appear to be average people, but they become so consumed by their cause of hatred that they take matters into their own hands. The fact is, and you may not believe it, but the fact is, you and I are capable of such actions if we do not resolve our conflicts. There are 70 murders every day in the United States, not counting suicide or abortion. And we're often shocked, aren't we, when we hear about another rampage, about another incident. But you know what? If you knew what was really in the hearts of men and women, our only surprise would be that there's not more such incidents. Unbridled anger is a destructive force. Now, often within the church, we don't kill people physically. We just destroy their reputation and we kill their influence. And Jesus here is restoring the original intent of the sixth commandment. He says it's not enough to refrain from killing each other. He says we must love our neighbor as ourselves. You see, that's the only cure, is that we love God with our whole heart and love our neighbor as ourselves. Whether or not you ever kill anyone, if you harbor unresolved anger and contempt and bitterness, according to verse 26, we become trapped by that hatred. And unless we settle these matters, it costs us. You may not kill the person you hate, but the hatred that you have may kill you. And Jesus tells in another passage about a man who refused to forgive and was turned over to his tormentors. I'm real interested in that word because it's the only time in the Bible it's used as a noun. When it's used as a verb, it describes physical or emotional or spiritual suffering. And the fact is, when we harbor unresolved disagreements, it has its effect on us physically and emotionally and spiritually. An unforgiving spirit will bring guilt and stress and resentment and bitterness and anxiety. And Jesus describes that as the prison that we build for ourselves. A medical doctor wrote that forgiveness can heal us from many physical ailments. 75% of all the people in the hospital have physical illnesses that are rooted in emotional dysfunction. When we do not resolve such issues, we literally punish ourselves. I'm quoting a psychiatrist now who said a clear conscience is a great step towards barricading the mind against neuroticism. People become emotional cripples because they do not resolve these issues. You know, those who are young may look at those who are older and say, boy, I never want to get in that shape. But you know, how we handle conflict and how we handle stress will determine the quality of life that we will have as we get older. I heard about a woman who thought that people were watching her. And so she built a high fence all around her house so nobody would watch her. Of course, it shut out all the sunshine, it ruined her lawn, and it cast a shadow on her house. She actually had imprisoned herself. And can you imagine all the people who walked by and said, what's all this about? Oh, there's just a crazy lady who lives inside. She wasn't always crazy. But she developed that paranoia because of unresolved fear. I knew of a psychiatrist who advised a man to quit going to football games. Actually, every time the team went in a huddle, he thought they were talking about him behind his back. And that's the distortion that comes when we don't resolve things. Look closer at verses 23 and 24. What Jesus is saying here is, do not use religion to justify your hatred. See, it's easy to go to the altar and pray that the Lord will zap all those bad people out there that we don't like. But what Jesus says is if you're at the altar praying and realize you have that kind of animosity, Jesus says quit praying. See, that's the pious thing to do, but he says do the practical thing. Get up from the altar, quit praying. This is the only time in the Bible I know where we're told to quit praying. It's easier to pray about some problems than it is to resolve them. And Jesus is so practical, isn't he? He says, I'm not impressed with all that praying, with all those tears and all that blubbering. Just get up and go tell the person you're sorry and get on with it. And so that's what he's really saying here. I heard of a woman one time who said, Pastor, when you serve communion, I want to know if I can be served all by myself. The pastor said, what's the problem? She said, I just don't want to be seen kneeling with all those other hypocrites. But you see, that destroys the whole symbolism of communion. See, this is a part of public worship. And this is what we do together. We have to learn to get along. We're going to spend eternity with everyone else, either up there or down there. So we're going to have to learn to get along. Now, I'll make this quick, but because my interest in church history, I am interested that the old Methodists had something called love feasts. Have you ever been to a love feast? Have you ever heard of a love feast? They are mentioned in Jude verse 12, and across the centuries, they've taken many different forms, but actually what we're having tonight, we call a fellowship dinner. But it's actually a love feast. It's actually a time when we get together and eat together just because we like each other. We're not simply eating to eat, but we're eating together because we like to be together. One of the things that used to happen in some of the old Moravian and Methodist love feasts is that people would go and break bread together and settle their differences. When there was tension, they would talk to each other and work out those differences. I don't know if this is a part of your vocabulary, but in the old days, people used to talk about bury the hatchet. Just work the differences out. And David said this in the Psalms. He said, it is good and pleasant for brethren to dwell together in unity. While I'm off on this tangent talking about church tradition, one of the other traditions that was associated with the love feast is that the rich would bring extra food and provide for the poor. Ironically, that's what we've been talking about this morning, isn't it? It's interesting that what we're doing is something that the Church of Jesus Christ has done in different ways across all of our history. And so we eat together. We provide for those who do not have food. And then we meet at the Lord's table as a show and display of our unity. I want to close this morning by sharing with you a true story. We have to go back to Richmond, Virginia. We have to go back to the year 1865. We have to go to St. Paul's Episcopal Church. There the minister had just given the invitation to the Lord's table when somewhere in the very back of the auditorium, an unknown black man got up, walked down the long aisle, and knelt at the altar. There was sort of an awkward hush. The Civil War had just been resolved earlier that year. There was still a lot of unresolved tensions. No one else got up and came to the altar. People were hesitant. They were looking around, not sure what to do. And then there was a gentleman who got up and went and knelt alongside of that black man. And that was sort of a signal. It was sort of the cue for the whole congregation. And after that man, they all got up and followed suit. If you're a history buff, it may be of interest for you to know that the man who broke the ice was Robert E. Lee, the great Southern general who fought for his principles during the Civil War, but understood that in God's house, we're all equal. So let me invite you to the Lord's table. You who truly walk in fellowship with God and are in harmony and love with your neighbor. You who truly repent of your sin and intend to lead a new life following the commandments of God, walking from this time in His holy ways. Draw near with faith and take this holy sacrament to your comfort and make your humble confession to Almighty God. I'll invite Pastor Adams to come and join me at the Lord's table now.